RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Professor Elizabeth Rata is a curriculum expert and sociologist at the University of Auckland. A member of various ministerial advisory groups, she co-chairs the Inter-University Academic Freedom Council. Her research explores the effects of racial categorization in education, leading to her theory of neo-tribal capitalism, which critiques the privatization of public resources in New Zealand. She directs the Knowledge and Education Research Unit and has authored influential works, including A Political Economy of Neo-Tribal Capitalism and the Research Handbook on Curriculum and Education. She was a founding member of Kura Kaupapa Māori. And we've invited Professor Rata to RCR this morning to talk about the indigenization of New Zealand universities. Professor Rata, welcome to RCR. Thanks for coming on this morning.
Thank you, Paul. Good to be here.
We'll be talking about Auckland University in a moment, but also the Free Speech Union have put out a submission on Massey University curriculum transformation discussion paper, and I just want to go through their summary because it kind of helps set the table. The discussion paper proposes major changes to the curriculum which will significantly impact academic freedom, say the FSU, namely, a shift from viewing the curriculum as collections of individually owned discrete blocks of disciplinary knowledge to centrally owned organizing framework, qualifications to be managed by a program committee who will have total control over courses, including the approval of any changes to content and assessments, and the university graduate profile prescribes institutional positions on te tiriti or waitangi and te tiriti related issues. Professor Rata, sounds like we're in dangerous waters, are we?
We are in very dangerous waters. We've been here for a long time. I would go back to the 2003 tertiary education strategy, which really gave, really started off the decolonization movement. And then it picked up pace with the Vision Mātauranga Māori document in 2006. So it's been going on for a long time, but it's really only since probably 2019, right, that we really see that those who are pushing for decolonization and indigenization of our universities are now in positions where they can do it.
Right. Okay. I've just, before our chat, read a piece that you wrote that was published in University World News in June. So a few months ago now, indigenization threatens the university's very foundations. Universalism. And that's where the word university came from, didn't it?
That's right, yeah. Universities are for the exploration of modern science, using the disciplines as a way to organise knowledge, I suppose. And modern science is about truth-seeking. It's universal. It's about finding empirical evidence. But more than anything, it's about explaining the how and the why of the properties and processes of the physical and social world. And of course, we'll never get to the truth, because one of the really important features of modern science is that there is constant criticism, there is constant challenge. And that's one of the key differences between what I call sociocultural knowledge and modern science.
Yeah, so I think you say that this could turn universities into faith-based institutions. Could you explain that?
Right. If I can have your permission, Paul, I'd like to sort of step back a bit and say what the difference is between two types of understandings of the world. The one I call
Yes, please.
Sociocultural knowledge, and that includes all traditional knowledge, Mātauranga Māori, but not just Mātauranga Māori, the traditional knowledge of all our ancestors, and it covers things like you know, spoken language, it covers our customs, it covers all the knowledge that we need to live in the world. It's absolutely essential for us to live, that sort of sociocultural knowledge. It's the knowledge we acquire as we grow up. We acquire it through observation, through experience. So it's absolutely essential, basic knowledge to be a human being. It's what socializes us into our group. But the other type of knowledge is modern science. Now, for millennia, our ancestors have lived without modern science. So we could, you know, as humanity, we could survive without modern science, but it would be the traditional world where we don't have, you know, all the advantages that we have, that modern science has enabled us to have. So modern science is completely different from the socio-cultural knowledge. And what has happened over the last, 30 to 40 years is there's been a conflation of the two. And in more recent years, the idea that they have sort of some sort of corresponding status or value. It's known as equivalence. It's called mana auditi, and it's the notion that these two ways of understanding the world have, because they are considered wrongly to be equivalent, therefore that sociocultural knowledge also has a place in the university to correspond in status and value with modern science. Well, it doesn't. The university is for the development and challenge of modern science. That's what universities are for, not for sociocultural knowledge. But I am not diminishing the value of sociocultural knowledge. I'm saying that it serves a different purpose. It has a place in the world, but universities are for science.
Where did that conflation then come from? Who drove it? I mean, what is the reasoning by them for it? Do we know?
Yes, we do. Yeah, it's a sort of unholy alliance between three major forces that sort of come together more so in New Zealand than elsewhere in the world. Postmodernism, the sort of intellectual movement of postmodernism, which is when intellectuals turn against their own intellect, and they regard the idea that there can be some sort of truth that we seek. They reject that and see everything in terms of who knows the knowledge, the knower rather than the knowledge itself. So it's very, very subjective. And it's a type of relativism where, because there is no such thing as truth or the truth that we seek, therefore all types of knowledge are considered to be equivalent. And postmodernism really came into the New Zealand University with the 1982 publication of a book called Māori Epistemologies by distinguished Professor Dame Anne Salmon. So she has had quite a major role in bringing in this notion of relativity, that all our ways of knowing things have some sort of equal status. And then by the late 80s, that idea became connected to retribalism. And then, as well as that, the third pillar of this unholy alliance, I call it, is Marxist critical theory. And right. At the same time, in the 1990s, Marxist critical theorists became very influential in faculties of education and throughout the social sciences. So you take those three things and you get enough people who adhere to the ideas, and it gained a momentum that has proved unstoppable.
Where is the thinking regarding the individual in all of this?
Well, if you, those three movements I referred to, they're all what I'd call communitarianist movements. They're all based on the notion of the primacy of the group over the individual. So if you look at Marx's critical theory, the group is understood in terms, in class terms. If you look at tribalism, the group's understood in terms of hereditary genetics. And if you look at postmodernism, the group is understood in terms of it's the knowledge of each group that is relative one to the other. So those three movements really push the notion of the group. And on the other side, liberalism and modern universities, modern science really owes everything to the notion that it's not just that knowledge is the result of the mind, and it's the individual who is the monad that thinks. So the thinking doesn't belong to the group. It is the individual mind that does the thinking. So in the modern world of the past 300, even 400 years, especially developed through with the Enlightenment, this idea that the individual is really important because two ways. It's the individual who thinks, plus if you tie that idea to democracy, to liberal democracy, then it is the individual who is the political category as the citizen. So in liberal democracy, the individual is absolutely central. And what these communitarian movements are doing is they are diminishing, they are reducing the value of the individual. And we will pay a huge price for this.
Yeah, I don't think Einstein came up with relativity with a committee, did he? He was sitting on a train looking at a clock face somewhere in Switzerland and got the idea. It was him. It was him.
Yes, it's the individual who thinks. Yeah.
Yeah. So this march that's been going on for 40 years, following those things, this re-tribalism, I can see what you're saying now. Does this have so much behind it that its force is... is what? How forceful is this movement now?
Well, I would have said until a few weeks ago that it was unstoppable. But I'm not so sure now. I think we're starting to see people grasping that this is really serious. This is about the future of the country. And if you take, let's just use the University of Auckland as an example. Now, at that university, my university, we have six people who have managed to get themselves into key senior administrative positions. And during these decades, the relationship of administrators to professors has changed. The status now belongs to the administrators, and there are many more of them. So if you have a sufficient number, sort of a critical mass, six people, the vice chancellor, various pro vice chancellors, for example, pro vice chancellor Māori, deputy pro vice chancellor Māori, pro vice chancellor education, the provost, people in really key positions, and there are now enough of them. They have been able to drive through what's called a curriculum framework transformation. And the word transformation is absolutely correct. It will completely transform the nature of Auckland University. And it's what's happening in Massey, that bit you read out.
Yep.
Same thing
yep.
going on at Massey. Not quite sure how far other universities are down this path. I know that they're in trouble too, but I don't think things are as bad as they are at Massey and at Auckland. So you've got these six very, very powerful people who have stated that this will occur, this transformation of the curriculum will occur. But then 2 weeks ago, a group of professors called the Senate held an extraordinary meeting, and 75% to 80% of them voted to put a pause onto this curriculum framework transformation. So the motion was to pause it. Since then, the senior administrators have said that it will go ahead regardless. But there's going to be another extraordinary meeting of Senate, and it will really be up to professors at the university whether they decide to save the place or not. It's in their hands, but at least the challenge is being made.
Who has more sway in the end? The professors, the academics, or the administrators? Because administrators are a dime a dozen in this world.
Oh, these aren't just ordinary administrators. These are administrators, senior ones, who have become administrators by through their academic careers, mainly postmodern doctorates. So they are a mixture of administrators and academics, but it's in their administration role that they are able to roll out these huge changes. Well, your question, sort of what will happen, I don't know. I'm of course waiting to see, because it's quite a crucial development that at last there is this challenge.
How are you being perceived, making comments, criticisms, laying it all out as an academic yourself, inside, you know, from the inside?
Oh, don't worry about that, Paul.
You're okay?
I've been, since the 90s, actually, I have been intrigued by, my scholarship is about the growing strength of various communitarian movements around the world, but with an emphasis on retribalisation in New Zealand. So I'm sort of deep in the scholarship of it all, and I just think about the ideas, really, and ignore the noise.
Yeah, yeah, okay. No, fair enough. It's interesting taking on board, how do I put it, Māori thinking, Māori ways by a broader section of non-Māori population, community, academic community, in this case in New Zealand. Is that interesting, that there's been some kind of morphing that's occurred there?
Well, it's fascinating, because I don't use the word Māori. I talk about this group as retribalists, because they include people who don't identify as Māori and don't have Māori ancestry. And of course, I would argue that the majority of Māori are not retribalists. They may well be, culturally Māori and fully engaged in cultural practices and beliefs, but the politics of retribalisation is a very different beast from being culturally connected to a particular group. No, in fact, it's interesting looking at many of these retribalists. I'll stick my neck out here. I don't have empirical evidence for this, but just when I look around, it seems to me that many retribalists are new arrivals in the country, often from England or from Australia or from the United States, and they bring with them almost a noble, savage approach to tradition, sort of real romanticisation of the past, and embrace all things. They're almost seduced by this very romantic notion that we are reviving the past. Well, we're not reviving the past. It's another word for it is cultivated tribalism. And I think that's what we're seeing. Highly educated, postmodernist educated people who are cultivating tribalism. And in the meantime, your real scientists are getting on doing the actual science, but suddenly realizing that they may not have an institution left where they can do, proper objective science.
The place of Te Tiriti, it's like there's an assumption that it's settled constitutional business. It's done. And everything that flows on from that is obvious because it's done, but it's not done, is it?
Gosh, no. Goodness, no. I mean, the idea of the treaty as a partnership is very recent. It's only from the 90s, late 1980s, 90s. And it's really, it's been pushed by this group of people because it's, in a way, it's the mechanism for retribalization. So it's actually really important. If you can convince enough people that there is a partnership, and the partnership is set in gold, in stone, in this sacred treaty. And of course, it's not sacred; it was a historical agreement,
Like millions of others the world has produced over thousands of years. Yeah.
But because it's the mechanism for retribalization, it's absolutely central to these people, and that's why you see it playing this role. And one of the this curriculum framework transformation at the University of Auckland involves having a compulsory first year course called Waipapa Taumata Rō, and included in this course, all students will be taught this particular version of the treaty. And of course, that way you are indoctrinating another generation of young people into a misrepresentation of a historical agreement.
And that perhaps explains the noise, use that word again, around some of what is being talked about politically at the moment. We all know what we're talking about, treaty principles, etc. Because if that falls away, the mechanism to entrench this and carry it on and build on it falls away as well. Right.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Right. Yeah. And that's why the treaty is being given this sort of sacred status, so that there's a sense it's untouchable. But of course, like everything in the modern world, everything must be up for challenge. But if you give it a sacred status, then it can't be challenged. And because of the role it plays as the mechanism for retribalization, then those who are pushing this do not want it to be challenged. So to all those who are challenging it, I say, you know, that's what liberal democracy is about. We should challenge everything. Shouldn't be a problem.
Richard Dawkins has weighed into this as well. Don't know if you're aware, but he's questioned playing whale songs into the Kauri forests to try and stop Kauri dieback as some, you know, way of dealing with that problem. And he's obviously, he doesn't have many good things to say about it. And I'm mentioning this because it's interesting. I found myself thinking, well, it might work. Who knows? There may be some spiritual thing we don't know about that connects there. But his main criticism is that is not science. You can't pass that off as science. So I guess there's an example of the two things that we started talking about, where you've got science and sociology. Both can work, right, in particular situations, but you can't call it science.
Now, I mean, belief is a really important part of sociocultural knowledge. And we, as I said earlier, we've got to have that knowledge because it's what gives us psychological stability. It gives a group, you know, its security, its sense of belonging. You know you're part of the group because people share these beliefs. So really important, but not science. And the other issue is, you know, maybe it's true that trees do respond to sound. Well, if that's the case, then we have to have a rigorous scientific investigation of that. But, of course, we can't do that because it's now almost impossible. Because tribalists have now got control of university funding, of university ethics procedures, for example, it would be impossible for a scientist to come along and say, here's an interesting idea, let's explore it, let's do the study, let's get the empirical evidence, let's develop a theoretical argument about for example, electricity, using, you know, the effects of sound waves or whatever, the science is involved. But you see, you can't do that because this type of sociocultural knowledge, traditional knowledge, when it's in the university, it cannot be challenged. And more than that, it can only be undertaken by those who claim a blood connection to it. So that immediately rules out your proper scientist who sees the problem and thinks, oh, I'd like to know more about this.
You said before that you had a bit of hope just in recent time, but, you know, the taxpayer funds a lot of university operations. I don't know by how much, but maybe you could tell us what the proportion of direct taxpayer funding for universities is these days. But we've all got skin in the game. If this carries on and doesn't stop, someone's going to have to call time on it. A politician, I don't know, somebody would have to say, enough, stop. And if it carries on, I don't know, what do? Reset the university somehow, shut them down, reboot them? What do you do?
Good gosh, that's a good question. Well, the money, I think it's about 70 to 80% comes from the government. So yes, there's a lot of money involved, and they are public universities. I mean, it's our university, University of Auckland. It's for the country. And it's not just the money that goes directly to the university. It's all the money that goes to research. It's the money that goes to what has become a disaster of a New Zealand Royal Society, which is completely captured by tribalists.
A disaster.
Yes, oh, absolute disaster. I mean, postmodernism now is now fully throughout the New Zealand Royal Society. So there's a lot of money that goes into the research infrastructure. So it's not just directly to the university. So when you've got that sort of money, I would say, and the influence of people at the top of a number of institutions, the universities, the New Zealand Royal Society, you know, various research groups who control the funding to research, then I think the only way we can turn this back, we can stop it actually, is through political will.
Yeah. And through the purse strings, ultimately.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, and politicians control the purse strings.
Are you seeing any activity in that area right now? Do you think they're just maybe standing back waiting to see what will happen? Or do you fear that politicians are, to use a word, infected with this ideology or thinking as well?
Well, the one area of hope is that there is a tertiary and ministerial advisory group which is looking into research very broadly. It's chaired by Sir Peter Gluckman. My hope, of course, is that there will be many submissions to that advisory group that will show quite clearly what the problem is, and that the advice from the group will be to the government will be, let's, you know, turn the ship around. So that's what I hope will be the case.
Is this a global phenomenon as well? I think you might have mentioned it at the start, but it just seems that so many things happen kind of in a lockstep these days. Is this happening everywhere? Is this part of a bigger sort of a global move by the postmodernists, the re-tribalists?
Well, in most parts of the world, they've been pushed back. But New Zealand, we seem to get particularly intense about things and take things to extreme. I think it's because our unholy alliance includes retribalism, but in other parts of the world where you've had sort of Marxism and postmodernism in this very odd alliance, given that intellectually they don't really fit, but they've been pushed back in the last, 10 years or so. Canada is is in dire straits, like New Zealand, for the same sorts of reasons. It's when this retribalization, this idea that somehow traditional knowledge is corresponds to, has the same status as modern science, that's where you see the disaster happening. But I think New Zealanders, I think we have become absolutely extreme.
Just to getting close to time now, I just want to go back to something you said before, because I think you made a very interesting point, and that is folks coming in from other countries with this sort of idealized vision of, I forget how you exactly described it, and you mentioned that's anecdotal, there's no empirical research on that, but I think you're right. I think you're right about that. I've noticed that, just saying. You know, and people I've interviewed in various areas who have been, you know, Californians, people from the UK, have had this kind of magical thinking feel to them. And I'm wondering if we don't want too many more of them, I'm thinking. Though I like people to come here, you know, I don't want to be discriminating. But if they're changing, this goes down to the, you know, what is the very soul of your country and your identity, doesn't it? If you, yeah.
They do get very excited about not just sort of the romanticized revival of the past, but, you know, social justice. There's a real socialist sort of Marxist flavor going on there too. Mm. And really well-meaning people, extremely well-meaning, but not really understanding our history. Our history is like the history of all countries. It's complex. There are no goodies and baddies. Life's not like that.
It's just an interesting aspect to it.
Yeah.
That I've noticed as well. And when you mention it, I thought about some of the people I've talked to here, and even taking on the language, using the Maori language phrases, you know, for their everyday language, and they've still got their accents, so it can't have been that long. Anyway, I don't want to go on about that. It's a fascinating situation we're in, Professor Rata, isn't it? I mean, it's worrisome, but it's also really interesting.
Yeah, well, as someone who's studied this for four decades, on one level, I find it absolutely fascinating, because a lot of the things I predicted would occur, have occurred, but I wish I was wrong. I wish they had not occurred. I wish I had, my ideas were completely wrong. Yeah. But, you know, liberal democracy, we fought really hard. Our ancestors, and this is from all around the world, have fought hard for liberal democracy. I don't think we're going to give it away so easily. Well, that's my hope, of course.
Let's leave it on that note. Professor Elizabeth Rata, thank you for joining us. It was really interesting to hear what you had to say.
Thank you.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.